shut the fuck up. We're all gonna die here. These are cops.
Oh, they're cops. Who gives a shit?
At least something I never told you about me. I hate fucking cops.
I got nothing to say.
Did you get the message? Did you get the message, boys and girls? I have nothing to say, and I don't look too kindly on most cops. I have nothing to say. Okay, you got it? Terrible Tommy here in the bunker. Tom Metzger, right here in north central Indiana, where we still have snow on the ground. Yeah, still have snow on the ground, a few inches. And doesn't show any signs of melting, so anyhow, it's about going to be maybe 15 degrees today. little chilly back here in the hot land, I tell you what. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, and it is February the 23rd, 2015, and man, these months roll by so fast it's hard to keep track of them. And this is Moon's Day again. Yeah, right back here in the bunker. Well, are you done rolling with laughter? Not me, boy. I'm telling you. This ISIS thing, these guys they're a lot smarter than they give them credit for. Like I said, they're putting out that they're going to hit these shopping centers all over. And they know what's going to happen. It's going to cause a semi-panic among these sheep, and the sheep are not going to go to shopping, and there's nothing you can do. I mean, you know, when they were attacking cops, that was one thing. A lot of people might say a lot of things about how they support cops, but they don't really get excited. But when they say they're going to mess with their shopping, man, and I might get in problems going to the shopping center, boy, none of that shit. So anyhow, if they keep that up, these corporations are going to lose a lot of money. It's not going to shut them down, but if those guys can cut them down by maybe 10% of their income, yeah, they operate on a pretty narrow margin, these big stores. So I think it's amusing, let's put it this way. I think it's amusing. And I didn't even give them... Well, wait a minute. No, I don't think I gave them that idea. But I've said things similar to that. Yeah. I used to say, if you want to really get them, you go after their toys. You only really piss off the ruling class. You don't go after people. You go after toys. So I did say that. I've said that a long time ago. There's nothing really destroys a powerful person like taking away the toys. If you take him away, well, he don't even know it. He's out of the picture. But you take his toys away, and oh, watch him cry. You know, speaking of Malcolm X, last few days, everybody's talking about Malcolm X. That's what they taught the system. A lot of people, well, everybody forgets things real fast. So when the riots came and they rioted down through Washington, D.C., right down through that one big boulevard that had all these Jew stores on it, burn them all down, the system got the message. They weren't afraid of Martin Luther King. They were upset with his anti-war position, which they may have knocked him off for, but the thing that these people really fear is when you attack their toys, their stores, and, you know, so forth and so on. And so evidently Malcolm X influenced that, which of course he didn't need to admit, but he was the firebrand that was promoting it. And I remember at the time laughing my ass off that they were burning out all those Jew stores in Washington, D.C. And also I had a belly laugh when the Hanafi Muslims took over the ADL building in Washington, D.C. and threatened to cut all the heads off the Jews in there and throw them out the window. I told you before, David Duke called me at the time. We were still working together. And he said, oh, this is terrible. This is horrible. I said, well, what's horrible about it? I think it's pretty cool myself. Those guys might as well have done it because they ended up doing probably 100 years in prison, you know. Well, here's something you better take note of. I think it's Durham, North Carolina. A Newmarket judge left no shades of gray in her decision to say no to racism. Maple man Eric Spence, who died 2 years ago at 71, tried to disinherit one of his two daughters because she had a baby with a white man. In her decision to set aside Spence's will that gave his entire $400,000 estate to his other daughter, Donna, a mother with whom he had no contact for more than 30 years, Judge C.A. Gilmore said, quote, it is clear and uncontradicted in my view that the reason for disinheriting Vera Lynn, as articulated by the deceased, was one based on a clearly stated racist principle. Are you listening? Does it offend public policy that the deceased's other daughter, Donna, should receive the entire estate simply because her children were fathered by a black man? That, in my view, offends not only human sensibility, but also public policy. Prior to becoming pregnant in 2002, according to lawyer Michael Deverett, and through affidavits filed in Newmarket Court, Vera Lynn Spence, 51, had a great relationship with her father, Eric. Quote, it's sweet victory, the will being set aside, in that it's contrary to public policy. But there's a lot of hurt there, said Deverett. Public policy? Oh, this was in Canada. The Jamaican-born Spence came to Canada from England in 1979 with daughter Vera Lynn after a breakup with his daughter's mother. He paid her way through university. Vera Lynn got a degree from New York University, then a law degree from a university in New York State. But according to court documents, he cut off all contact with her in 2002 when she revealed she was pregnant by a white man. Now, before you stand up and cheer and clap, you got to understand this sword can swing both ways. And I respect the black guy for doing that, but you got to understand that can happen either way. But that's in Canada. But, you know, whatever screwball law comes down from any other country will probably end up here sooner or later. When it came time to dispense his $400,000 estate, the entire proceeds were given to daughter Donna, who remained in England when Spence came to Canada and with whom he had no contact for the last 30 years of his life, according to court records. The judge cited McCorkill decision in New Brunswick, where the judge voided the will of a man who left all his possessions to the National Alliance Group on the basis that it violated public policy and Canadian hate laws. That ruling is under appeal, which is going to cost National Alliance a lot of money if they can win it. Deverett said his client just wants to get on with her life and doesn't want to talk to the media, said it was a very difficult process for Vera Lynn. Quote, to have to go through all of that, it was very difficult for her emotionally, he said. They, father and Vera Lynn, had a great relationship. He was fully supportive of her. He put her through the university, one degree after another. Everything was going smoothly and wonderfully, and then boom. The gentleman, Eric Spence, didn't really have any friends. It's a shame that he lives his life this way and that he couldn't even be spoken to about the possibility of reconciliation with Vera Lynn. He was clear. Unquote. Well, I talked to Eric Glebe after it was announced that this person was going to, had willed all this money to National Alliance. And I said, why in the hell, since the man was old and infirm, didn't he take at least half of that material, money and whatever, box it up, have somebody put it in the back of their car and drive it down to National Alliance in West Virginia? Because with these kind of laws, public policy to where they can totally go around what your desires are in a will, your money, nothing's safe in Canada. And you either that or you should, people in Canada who want to will things to people at some time or another, put the money in an American bank and with a copy of the will. And this is ridiculous. These damn rats are getting people's hard-earned money. Now, this guy, this black guy, was absolutely right. He's a black separatist. His daughter married a white man. He said, screw that. They're not getting my money. But they did. So anyhow, anybody that you're thinking of willing money to, you might think of giving them a pretty good chunk early on. Not that it would affect your ability to pay your bills and so forth like that. Or put that money in some form in a lockbox or deposit in a bank and put your will in that box. Because a lot of times kids and so forth, relatives who find a will in your house or on your property will destroy the will. And that, I went through something like that years ago. And luckily we were able to get around it. So, you know, we all think we're going to live forever. But that's something, if you really want to help somebody out in the struggle. And a situation where kids have gone totally the other way and not doing anything or don't agree with your politics or anything else, and you want to help somebody who does, well, make arrangements long before you roll a seven, as Carl Strait used to say. Anyhow, that's, but if you got any money and you're in Canada, I would say get your money out of Canada and bank it down here in the States. Well, let's go back to the man called Lucy here, the super spy that, was responsible for the destruction of Germany's move into Russia, really, or at least most of it. The rest of it was because the Enigma machine had been captured and remanufactured and figured out. Okay. Finally, Roessler, the Jew, became secretary of the Bochum Volksbund, an organization devoted to the development of the theater, and director of the magazine Das National Theater in Berlin. Meanwhile, his 10 military friends had all obtained good positions at the Reichswehr headquarters, and it was through them that Roessler's intellectual influence reached its peak when he was invited to join the very selective Herren Club in the Volksstrasse in Berlin. Up until the crisis that overtook the Reichswehr in 1930, Rudolf Roessler was to give no fewer than 2,000 lectures there. With the Wall Street crash, the Weimar Republic stood once again on the verge of ruin. Its economic base on American loans and on exports collapsed. Unemployment mounted. The army received its first great setback. On September 20, 1930, the 10 friends of RR, as they called Roessler among themselves, finally woke up. They had been deaf to his innumerable warnings, but suddenly, on that day, the ground collapsed from beneath them. There was to be an important trial before the Leipzig Supreme Court. Three lieutenants from the garrison at Ulm, Wilhelm Schranger, Wendt, and Hans Leuden, were accused of spreading Nazi propaganda within the Reichswehr. The membership in Hitler's party was enough to exclude any prospective soldier from membership in the 100,000. This had been decided by General von Seeckt. His edict was included civilians working in the arsenals and the military stores. There were to be no fascists in the army. Yet, despite this, the officer corps, particularly its young elements, had become contaminated. But Schweringer, Wendt, and Leuden were also accused of a much more serious crime, high treason. They had tried to persuade their fellow soldiers not to open fire on Hitler's supporters in the event of an armed uprising. General Wilhelm Groener, the defense minister, wanted to have the lieutenants brought before a simple court-martial in order to avoid unsavory publicity. But Schweringer had secretly alerted the Volkischer Beobachter, the Nazi newspaper. Everything would take place in the open, and the trial would reveal how far the gangrene had already advanced. Adolf Hitler, summoned as a witness for the defense, could hardly have hoped for a better public platform. He had long been waiting for an opportunity to dissipate the mistrust the Reichswehr instinctively felt toward him. He would captivate the army with his favorite tactic, the lie. The fate of the three young lieutenants was of little importance to him, compared with his larger aim, securing the support of the officer corps. He would simply disown his three disciples in order to reassure the others. These three young men were quite wrong, he declared, to believe that we would ever contemplate armed rebellion. We will use only constitutional means to gain power. I will never fight the army. Quite the contrary, when the government of our country is in my hands, which will be in a matter of months, I shall regard you, gentlemen, as the essential nucleus from which the great army of German people will emerge, unquote. Lost among the crowd of military spectators, Roessler's friends were struck with terror at the hypnotic power of the street politician's arguments, while around them their colleagues were swiftly seduced by Hitler's reassurance. In that troubled time, most of the soldiers of the Reichswehr lacked both confidence and a sense of purpose. Many were beginning to wonder whether this National Socialism, which was regarded as a danger and which claimed to be capable of assuming the destiny of the nation, might not, after all, be what the German people needed to restore their country's former greatness and to shake off the humiliating shackles imposed on them by the Treaty of Versailles. As if he guessed the hopes of his audience, Hitler went on. quote, Germany is bound hand and foot by the peace treaties. We National Socialists do not regard these treaties as having the force of law. They were imposed upon us. We cannot allow that our sons, who are innocent, remain under this yoke. If we protest these treaties with every means at our disposal, we will find ourselves on the road to revolution. Hitler declaimed his speech, one hand on his heart, the other brandished with a clenched fist. It had its effect. A cold shudder passed through the courtroom, followed by tumultuous applause. The minutes of the trial leave no doubt of this. Looking back, it seemed inconceivable that Leipzig judges could have tolerated such an outburst, but the event must be seen in its historical context. Perhaps they, too, were moved by Hitler's speech. Most of the audience on that occasion were deeply impressed and felt suddenly well disposed towards a political movement that declared itself ready, according to its leader, to support the army, instead of sapping its strength as they had feared. Hitler restrained his delight. He had taken the Reichswehr in completely. They would pay for this later in mass. The sentences passed on the three condemned lieutenants, 18 months each, satisfied no one. For those who sympathized with Hitler, they were too heavy. For those, far too light. If the judges had acted with greater severity, respecting the rules and disciplines of the Reichswehr, they would have done much to revive the army's confidence. It would no doubt have recovered quickly enough from the shock it had experienced while listening to Hitler. The hesitancy of the Leipzig judges completely demoralized the army. It was hopelessly divided by the activities of the ever more numerous and arrogant supporters of Hitler. Even General von Seeckt himself, though later deprived of his functions, was temporarily a Hitler backer and insisted that his sister vote for the ex-corporal rather than for Marshal Hindenburg. On the evening of September the 20th, 2030, Roessler and his small circle sized up the situation. They now felt certain that, exasperated by the weakness of the Weimar Republic and with nothing in their bellies, the German people were willing to embark on an era of madness. They would make the worst possible choice, Nazism, the negation of German culture. They would give their support to men who had no coherent or rational philosophy and who would act as merciless butchers. Hitler had said as much during the Leipzig trial. It had slipped out during his interrogation by the president of the tribunal. Quote, I can assure you that when National Socialist movement is victorious, there will be a National Socialist Court of Justice. Our revolution will take its revenge and heads will fall. Unquote. No reasonable man could lend his support to these future masters of Germany, thought Roessler's friends. On the contrary, he should fight ruthlessly against them. Little time remained for them to prepare their secret resistance, to work out their plans of detail. Events were rushing ahead. 34 months later, after Leipzig trial, on July 14, 1933, the Nazi Party, now completely in power in Germany, issued a decree. Quote, the National Socialist Party of German Workers is the only legal political party in Germany. Whoever tries to preserve or found any other political party will be condemned to a maximum sentence of 3 years hard labor or from 6 months to 3 years in prison, unless the crime is punishable by more serious penalties under the terms of other laws, unquote. Hitler had triumphed, destroying all legal opposition. A month later, in August 1933, Rudolf Roessler met a young Swiss citizen in Berlin, Xavier Schnieper. Schnieper was 23 years old and the son of an important magistrate in the canton of Lucerne. Because of his left-wing ideas, he was regarded as the black sheep of the family. He was studying for his doctorate in philosophy and was passionately concerned over the upheavals that he foresaw in Europe. Anyone, he maintained, could see that what would happen merely by analyzing the Nazi rise to power. And there was no better vantage point than Berlin. It was there that he became friendly with the director of Revue, Das National Theater, which was rather too right-wing for his taste, but he liked Rudolf Rösler himself, that fiercely independent man, man who was forever repeating Luther's words, quote, "I'm standing and cannot do otherwise," unquote. Sniper soon realized, however, from his frequent conversations with Rösler, that he was capable of far more than writing articles for a theater review. Of how much he did not yet know. But it was he who suggested to Rösler that he go and settle in Switzerland where he would be safe. Rösler did not hesitate. With his wife Olga and only 10 marks in his pocket, the most one was allowed to take out of Germany at that time, he boarded the train for Lucerne. What did money matter? Peace of mind would make their exile less bitter. When all the officers of the Army High Command were compelled shortly afterwards to take the oath of allegiance to the Führer before General Werner von Fritsch in the great hall of the Reichswehr Ministry in Berlin, Rösler's 10 friends did not reveal themselves, but at the same time, silently, they each made another promise to do whatever in their power to defeat Hitler and Nazism. Germany was entering into a dark night of madness. Yet a delicate thread linked the 10 officers to the free world, to light. At the end of the thread was their friend Rudolf, some 600 miles away. He waited, ready to be of use. From 1934 on, Rudolf and Olga Rösler lived in a small flat in West Semlin, a suburb of Lucerne, 2.5 miles from the city center. Every morning, punctually at 7:30, Rösler would arrive at a small publishing house situated among the winding streets of the old town. The Vita Nova Verlag, of which he was the manager until his death in 1958, was founded by a group of his Swiss friends, its offices at 36 Falmestrasse. No longer exist, but Rösler's colleagues still live in Lucerne today. Day after day, with obstinate patience, Rösler devoted himself to his task. In article after article, pamphlet after pamphlet, he laid bare the ravages that Nazism was inflicting on Germany. The ammunition for his writings came, of course, from Berlin. Almost every day he received a letter from one of his German friends in which confidential intelligence was concealed in apparently innocent gossip. Sometimes, too, one of the 10 would come and visit Rösler in Lucerne. Thanks to them, Rösler announced in his pamphlets a month in advance the Wehrmacht's intended occupation on March 7, 1936, of the demilitarized zone of the Saarland. Exposed the events leading up to the fall of General von Fritsch and the seizure of Austria. But above all, he published political analysis in which he revealed that the true nature of the new, aggressive, prosperous Germany that so impressed the Western democracies. Rösler and his 10 friends could not accept as their own this new Germany that arrested thousands of Catholic priests and Protestant pastors, that disbanded the Christian youth movements and forbade the publication of any works of a spiritual nature, that burned tens of thousands of books, poisoning the roots of German thought, that controlled every sphere of the country's cultural life, that excluded the Jews from artistic activity and destroyed 6,500 works of art which the Nazis regarded as decadent. They attacked the Nazification of education, the falsification of history, and the degeneration of the sciences. They hated this regime that banned non-Nazi newspapers, turned journalists into mouthpieces for the propaganda ministry, and exercised strict control over the film industry. They bitterly criticized a German that returned to a feudalized system of agriculture, in which the peasant was confined to his piece of land and his work rigorously controlled, that he reduced the industrial worker to the level of a serf, controlled the movement of labor and increased income tax, that had Nazified its entire civil service and judicial profession, that had set up the dreadful people's courts and opened 50 concentration camps since 1934. Swiss readers might well be astonished by the revelations of this inexhaustible anti-fascist who signed himself R.A. Hermes. Why Hermes? Hermes was the son of Zeus, but much more to the point, he was the messenger of the gods. The choice name of names was no accident. From about the middle of 1939 onward, Roessler's role as messenger was suddenly to take quite a different proportions. So different and so vital that his previous literary work was to seem comparable a small amount. On May 23rd in Berlin, an event took place that was to have profound historical significance. That day, the Führer called a meeting of his army chiefs at the Chancellery. Hitler seemed nervous. The day before, he had signed the Steel Pact, inextricably linking the fate of Italy and Germany. Opposite him sat 14 officers, including Göring, the General Erhard Milch for the Luftwaffe, Admiral Erich Raeder, and Rear Admiral Otto Schwein for the Kriegsmarine, and Wilhelm Keitel, Walter von Brausnitsch, and Franz Halder for the Wehrmacht. Hitler wasted no time in discussion. As William L. Scheer remarks in The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, none of those officers left the Chancellery on May 23rd without a very clear idea of what the summer held in store. Quote, "No more victories can be won without bloodshed," Hitler declared, according to the notes of the meeting made by Lieutenant Colonel Schmidt. "We must expand to the east in order to guarantee our food surpluses, our supplies, and also resolve the problem of the Baltic states. There is no other course to be taken in Europe. If we are forced by fate to come to grips with the West, the possession of a vast territory in the East will be an incalculable advantage. There can be no question of sparing Poland. We shall attack her at the first favorable opportunity. War will break out. If Great Britain and France support Poland, then they too must be attacked. The Dutch and the Belgian air forces must be occupied militarily. Declarations of neutrality cannot be respected. We must make a lightning attack on Holland. Our aim must be the establishment on Dutch territory of a defense line going right up to the Zuider Zee. The war with Britain and France will be the fight to the death. The idea that we shall be able to avoid this is a dangerous one. It will no longer be a matter of being right or wrong, but whether or not there is to be 80 million Germans. The 14 officers sat hypnotized. Not one dared to interrupt Hitler's analysis. In 1937, the Führer had suggested similar plans of aggression to his military chiefs. Werner von Blomberg and von Fritsch had protested on the grounds that Germany lacked the forces necessary to win a European war. But von Blomberg and von Fritsch were no longer there. This time Hitler was not making suggestions, he was giving orders. He digressed on the subject of Britain and the character of the British people. This was what haunted him, the British lion. He repeated himself as though trying to convince himself of the rightness of his decision. Finally, the Führer ordered his officers to pay particular attention to the outlines he would give them of a strategic plan that they were to work out in great detail. The objective must be to deal with the enemy a crushing, absolutely decisive blow at the outset. No consideration of right or wrong or of treaties must interfere with the plan's execution. We must prepare both for a long war and for a surprise attack. Any possible intervention by Britain on the continent must be stopped immediately. The Army must occupy the positions essential to the Navy and to the Luftwaffe. If we succeed in occupying Holland and Belgium, together with France, we shall have the basis for a victorious war against Britain. Taking off from the west of France and the Luftwaffe will be able to exert a strict blockade against Britain, and the blockade will be completed by our submarines. The decisive condition for success is secrecy. I shall reveal my objectives neither to Italy nor to Japan, and I regret to say I cannot entirely trust my high command. Our plans must not be communicated to them. Form a small commission within the OKW whose task it will be to draw up the military details of the plan. Perhaps Hitler was already suspicious. German agents in Switzerland sifted every word that was published concerning German problems. Naturally, they had read the writings of that mysterious Hermes, yet his reports did not constitute a betrayal of defense secrets. The Führer's apprehension could be due to nothing more than his instinctive mistrust. However, his fears were fully justified. On May 30th, two Germans in civilian dress got out of the train at Lucerne, Generals Fritz T. and Rudolf G., the leaders of the small conspiracy in Berlin. They had come from the Reich. Rudolf Rosler took the precaution of receiving them at his home in Westmorland. The Vita Nova Verlag might be watched by the German spies. Rudolf G. began, quote, "War will break out in a matter of weeks, 3 months at the latest. Hitler has decided on it on the 23rd of this month." Quote, "Are you sure?" asked Rosler. "Positive." The Führer had never entirely trusted the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht. He wants the job drawn up. The Wehrmacht's plans of attack will be confined to a small commission. Brauchitsch and Halder have just asked us to join it. Rudolf G. continued empathetically, "Nazi Germany must not win this war." "Has she any chance of winning it?" Rosler asked. "Who knows?" Thomas, the economic chief of the OKW, has just pronounced his estimates. In 4 years, the Wehrmacht has expanded from 7 to 51 divisions. The Luftwaffe has 21 squadrons and 270,000 highly trained men. Not enough, of course, to take on all of Europe. He then revealed Hitler's intention to try and break the conflict up into manageable pieces, beginning with Poland. This would give him time to continue the military build-up before attacking the West. German industry was expanding at a colossal rate, working entirely for the army. If it were not beaten at once, he cautioned, the Wehrmacht would become a terrible, powerful instrument. Hitler was taking a chance, convinced that Britain and France would not stand in his way. "The breakup has come," murmured Rosler. "We shall win," Rudolf G. went on excitedly. "We shall bleed this Germany that we have disowned to its death so that our Germany may be reborn. You know why we joined the Wehrmacht when it superseded the Reichswehr? We were waiting for an opportunity. Brauch and Halder have given it to us." He reviewed the reasons for their optimism: the vital importance of their posts in operations, logistics, transport, military economy, and communications, and the most important, their own appointment to the small commission. Try as they might, the Nazis could not do without experts. They had to admit that at least the Reichswehr knew how to train soldiers. Rudolf G. assured Rosler that they would send him all intelligence of any importance to use as he saw fit. Quote, "Give it away or sell it as you wish, to whom you may wish, but preferably to the staunchest enemies of Nazism." Rosler regarded the two generals in silence. At last he said, quote, You understand where this will lead you. Once we have begun, there is no turning back. You realize this. It was Rudolph G. who replied. Of course, don't worry. We've always considered you our conscience. Now we need you more than ever. We shall not be able to see or even to write to each other. So Fritz will explain to you how we shall communicate from now on. General Fritz T. had been able to get a small trunk through customs at Basel. It was a great risk, of course, but it was the only way. Time was running out. The trunk contained radio telegraphic equipment, a shortwave transmitter, and a receiver, one of the latest models issued only to the Wehrmacht. Fritz T. had taken it from the stores of the broadcasting department in the form of spare parts. It had been an easy matter to get a hold of the instructions for assembling the set and to reconcile the inventory records to disguise the theft. Did Roessler have a friend in Switzerland whom he could trust, who could put the equipment together, and who knew enough Morse code to act as an operator? Roessler knew someone who fit the description exactly, a German emigre called Christian Schneider, working for the International Labor Office in Geneva. But he would simply ask Schneider to assemble the set and teach him how to operate it. Roessler would do the transmitting himself. The fewer people involved in the conspiracy, the better. Fritz T. agreed. He turned the equipment over to Roessler with the codes and the lists and the wavelengths that would be used. Roessler's friends had laid their plans meticulously. Eight of them, simply by the virtue of their post, were at a very source of intelligence concerning the Wehrmacht's movements. Each transmission of news concerning the army would be preceded by the word Werther, simply because the first two letters of the title of Goethe's work are also those of the Wehrmacht. The other two conspirators, high-ranking officers in the Luftwaffe, would communicate any intelligence concerning the Air Force, but it would pass through the same channel as the other. This news would be announced by a different signal, Olga, the name of Roessler's wife. How could the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht allow such an important and continuous leak to be so easily set up and remain undetected? Many observers have remarked that as the war continued, the OKW became more like a public meeting than a powerful disciplined command center. By taking over on February 4, 1938, the post of Supreme Commander of the Wehrmacht, War Minister, and Commander-in-Chief of the Wehrmacht, Hitler intended to concentrate all his forces in his own hands. As a result, he created a Frankenstein. In 1925, under the iron rule of General Hans von Seck, the Reichswehr command comprised no more than 220 high-ranking officers, assisted, of course, by a large contingent of civil servants. By 1933, this number had doubled. In 1939, the Wehrmacht high command seemed as if it had been possessed by an absolutely irresistible tendency to expand. There were now 2,000 officers of all ranks and 7,000 civil servants. This swelling of the numbers of the OKW was to continue at a rapid increasing rate until 1940. There were double the numbers of army officers wearing the purple stripe down their trousers. Each of the commanding officers appointed by the Führer brought their own retinue with him, which he duly added to that his predecessor, and which in turn he left to his successor when he moved on. There were a strata of every loyalty and shade of opinion. A superficial examination of the OKW quickly revealed who von Seck's men were, then von Blumberg's and von Frisch, then those of Beck and von Braunwitz, Halder, Zeigler, Guderian, and Krebs. In addition, there were the favorites of the movement, appointed by Wilhelm Keitel, Alfred Jodl, or Hitler himself, as a simple demonstration of faith in Nazism. This mass of officers were jammed into the offices of the Tirpitz embankment. embankment, the Wilhelmstrasse, the Benderlaustrasse, and in the Maybach camp at Zossen at the gates of Berlin. The cleverest among them succeeded in getting appointed to the Führer's own headquarters, which followed Hitler wherever he went. The OKW swarmed with fierce competitive cliques and festered with repressive jealousy and rancor. The great thing was to avoid any serious responsibilities and therefore any chance of making an irredeemable mistake, which would be enough to get one sent to active service on the front. And the entire organization was under constant surveillance by agents of the Gestapo. Outside this world of intrigue and violent internal convulsion were a number of technicians more interested in improving the Reichswehrmacht's efficiency than attending parades and receptions. Among them were Roessler's 10 friends. The surrounding anarchy produced by an over-concentration of power acted as a perfect screen for their activities. It was easy enough for them to obtain the strategic plans and the details of the Wehrmacht's movements because they were among the men who produced them. They were then transmitted to Rudolf Roessler from the official broadcasting center of the OKW itself. Inside this building were two huge halls that buzzed incessantly night and day with the noise from nearly 100 transmitter receivers. On one side was a long row of small offices housing the coding technicians who held the keys to the OKW dispatches. The wireless operators knew nothing but simply transmitted uncomprehendingly the long series of Kabbalistic letters they were given, taking note of the times and the wavelengths indicated in the margin of every message. In the same way, they would record without the slightest idea of their meaning the floods of mysterious dots and dashes they received. Fritz T. was one of the assistants to General Erich Feldgebel, the head of the communications department, with practically the entire center under his direct control. There were a number of wireless operators he could depend on, among them two sergeants who had good reason to be grateful to him. Nothing ever surprised them. They never asked questions. In turn, they transmitted the messages of Werther and Olga without any awareness of what or to whom they were communicating. Fritz T., having coded everything beforehand, and Roessler, being for them rarely one correspondent among many others, known only as RAHS, his call number. Fritz T. did everything possible to reduce the chances of discovery. He insisted on his transmission should never last longer than half an hour except in extraordinary circumstances. The longer dispatches were to be broken up and spread over several days if necessary. Roessler was never to call either of his two sergeants. In the event of an unexpected silence on Roessler's part, Werther and Olga would know that something had happened and would not try to contact them. It would be up to Roessler to reestablish contact, which he would do by sending out his signal RAHS for several days in succession at midnight. His friends in Berlin were then to reestablish contact. The plan had its risks, of course, but it was one with a very good chance of success. However, if the break came from Berlin, Roessler could do nothing more than pray for the safety of his friends. A prolonged silence would mean that the Gestapo had arrested everyone. The machine could now be turned on, and they had only to await the Führer's decisions to feed into it. Each one would be turned against him and contribute to its ultimate irrevocable fall. He would thus destroy himself. This simple, meticulous plan could not fail. Of course, its results would not be evident at once. There would be no sudden, spectacular reversals, but in time they would do their work. Only one problem remained, and it was no minor one. How and to whom was the mass of intelligence that would soon begin flowing be given? This was up to Roessler. For a long time he considered his options. Make the rounds of the Allied embassies, his wares under his arms, No one would take him seriously. He would be dismissed as an agent provocateur. There was only one answer, Switzerland. She had generously taken him in 1933. If she saw fit, she would distribute the information to the nations concerned. Roessler dared not admit to himself that he would be offering his hostess a poisoned present. For if she did as he asked, she would be jeopardizing her neutrality. A few days after his two co-conspirators had returned to Berlin, Roessler arranged to meet Xavier Schneiper. The young Swiss had become a close friend. However, Roessler was careful not to entrust him with the whole truth of what he was doing. The most devoted friend does not reveal what he does not know. That's a point for you all to remember. He told Schneiper, quite simply, that an absolutely reliable source had informed him that the war would break out shortly. Moreover, through his contacts in Berlin, he would be in possession of exceptional and continuing intelligence, which he would like to communicate to the Allies. There was a simple motive for all this indiscretion. Roessler knew that since the spring of that year, Xavier Schneiper had been serving as a soldier in a branch of the Secret Service, directed by Brigadier Roger Mason, head of the Swiss intelligence. It had been Schneiper himself who had confided in him. He had been recruited on account of his journalistic work and also because he knew Germany well. He had often been asked if he knew anyone who might be useful to the service. Would Roessler allow him to propose his name? The German emigre accepted with alacrity. So Schneiper introduced him to Major Hans Hausermann and his colleagues. Hausermann owned a large photographic shop near Zurich railway station. Before the war, he had the reputation of belonging to the extreme right, and yet there could have been few Swiss more hostile to Nazism than he was. Well before 1939, sensing the need to provide his country with secret eyes and ears, he developed through his business a series of personal contacts throughout Europe, from Italy to Finland, which might, if necessary, be transformed into an intelligence service. Brigadier Mason had been delighted to discover this private network and quickly mobilized Hausermann, leaving him, of course, a considerable amount of autonomy. Moreover, he set up Hausermann up with his own staff in the Villa Stutz at Kastanienbaum, about 5 miles south of Lucerne, on a tip of land that protrudes far into the lake. The center was christened Bureau HA. If an up-to-date analysis of the political situation in Germany was required, the Bureau HA supplied it. If observation of German diplomats in Switzerland or protection of Swiss diplomats in Germany was needed, the Bureau was called in, and it was the Bureau HA that sent Swiss agents into Germany. Other branches of Mason's service also sent spies into the Third Reich, usually dressed as privates or non-commissioned officers of the Wehrmacht, and supplied with splendid forged papers made in Bern, which allowed them to almost any garrison in Germany. Occasionally, these spies had extremely unfortunate experiences on their return to Switzerland, like the spy who managed to steal in Germany a Panzerfaust or bazooka with its shell. On his return, he was arrested at Col de Roche by Corporal Chevalier of the Swiss Customs, who would not let him enter the country because he did not have an import license for his weapon. This produced a fine scandal that the Customs Service had great difficulty in hushing up. But customarily, this kind of exploit was handled by Bureau HA. In the event of some unfortunate incidents, it was easier to disown them, since they were semi-clandestine in any case. Well, semi-clandestine. Xavier Schneiper introduced his friend Roessler as an accomplished military specialist and praised his highly placed contacts in Germany. Without waiting for an answer, Roessler laid down his role, but essentially conditioned he must never be questioned as to the sources of his information. While this was highly unorthodox, Major Hausman agreed. He knew too much about this kind of contact to insist. He would content himself with judging the recruit by his work. He was not to be disappointed. The Berlin-Lucerne Intelligence Service worked very well indeed. Suddenly, on the night of Wednesday, August 23, 1939, the transmitter receiver given to Roessler by Fritz T. began to crackle. That morning, the chief of the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht had held an extraordinary meeting with General Halder, had told him of the order given the night before by the Führer, quote, D-Day against Poland, fixed for Saturday the 26th, unquote. In fact, after a last desperate diplomatic maneuver by Britain and France, it was not until dawn of September 1st that the troops of the Wehrmacht crossed the Polish frontier en masse and converged on Warsaw from the north, south, and west. On September 2, 1939, war was declared. Werther and Olga began their work of destroying the regime that had been intended to last 1,000 years. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. I find this book fascinating, and a whole lot of stuff that fills in a lot of blanks in my historical knowledge. And it's just plain fascinating, and many of these tactics will have to be employed as time goes on in this country, because this country is moving towards a total police state with some kind of dictatorship. They won't be called a dictatorship, but it'll be that just the same. Every day I see them inching forward a little bit. So you're going to have to learn how to handle intelligence information and how to have contacts all over the country. And forget all the right-wing noise in the background. Let them rave on. Let them rave on. Let the press go on and on about their stupid understanding of lone wolves and all that, which they're like a bunch of babbling, crowing crows in the trees. Keep your eye on the ball. And if you're someplace where you can dig in to the system deep, keep your mouth shut. They're going crazy because I read something out of my, one of the papers that somebody sent me about the lone wolf or whatever. Keep quiet, keep your mouth shut, and don't trust anybody. Well, hell, a lot of businessmen say that stuff. I mean, there's nothing sinister about that. I mean, it depends on how you look at that stuff. So as time goes on, there's going to have to be a lot of underground intelligence gathering and but few contacts. And books like this will help you out, help us out. I know you're out there. I can hear you breathing. But in the meantime, take this bit that I've recorded to heart, because it's the truth.
And I always knew I was doing the right thing, because you have a steadiness about you, and I believe in you. But it comes on, and you must be smarter than your enemy. What are you trying to say? The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body's cold. You do it a million times. They never get it, because the real solution always eludes them. Do nothing. sound system. All you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.